Now, from the WMAL WynnBET Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton is our producer this morning. And we have snow in the forecast. As if inflation wasn't bad enough, now we got more snow coming. So we're going to lead off the show with the importance of the weather, because as we saw last time, when we didn't take it so seriously, people were stuck on I-95 for 24 hours. So we're going to head right over to the Storm Watch 7 Weather Center. Alex Liggett is there this morning. He's keeping an eye on things. And Alex, it looks a little ominous when you see that it's going to be very cold on Sunday early in the day, and then we have the precipitation coming our way. So what are you expecting here?
We're really going to see this start as all snow. So, I mean, the main takeaway that I've been trying to tell everyone is just try to get off the roads as we get towards early tomorrow afternoon. We're talking 2, 3 o'clock at the latest. I think that is really when snow is going to begin around the D.C. metro. And it will continue to come down pretty heavy at times all the way through the evening until it changes over, I think, probably a few hours after sunset to sleet, freezing rain, and eventually all rain.
Now, often when it begins to snow, the pavement is warm. And it takes a while for the pavement temperature to come down and the snow to start to stick. But with the temperatures very cold leading into Sunday, what is that going to mean when it begins to snow for people who are driving?
Well, you know, particularly those areas that may have not been treated. I mean, even the regions that have been really so cold in the teens early tomorrow morning, 20s the majority of the day tomorrow, that, you know, whatever falls, it's going to stick pretty quickly. So those roads are going to become snow covered very quickly. And with it being so cold, our snow ratios might be a little bit higher, meaning we could have some heavier snow rates to begin with for this storm than people are going to really anticipate.
And for those people that sustained damage to trees and shrubs and things, is this going to be kind of a different composition than the most recent one we had, where it was a very heavy snow and it just weighted all the limbs down?
I do think this will be more of a dry, fluffy snow until it changes over to rain. Now, just because the temperatures are so cold, you got to remember, not only are the road temperatures maybe below freezing, but also the trees. So they could get a little bit of icing before the surface temperature really warms above freezing. We could also have some gusty winds. This is a really potent system. There's some really strong winds right off the surface. Hopefully they don't mix down completely, but there is that potential for some wind gusts upwards of 40 miles per hour. So that could lead to some sporadic power outages as well.
Now, you mentioned things are going to change to rain. What does it look like for Monday morning for a commute?
You know, Monday morning, you know, luckily with it being Martin Luther King Jr. Day, government schools out, that should help. But, we are expecting temperatures to warm into the 40s overnight. So just kind of some residual slush on the roads early Monday morning. In temperatures, they should remain at or above freezing as we head towards Monday as well. So that should also help, too, just saying that we won't have as much of a refreeze threat as we get towards Monday.
And one last question. When you contrast the storm that stranded everyone on I-95, what's different about this one? What or is it? And you know, what can we feel a little better about going into this one?
Well, on that one, on that Saturday, I was not expecting snow in D.C. come Sunday night to Monday. This one, there is so much model agreement. That one, we literally did not see until the day of really seeing the best chance for snow move in. This one is not much of a surprise storm, and also just the track for this a lot farther west. With that being said, we'll get a lot more warm air mixing in, and that will help things change over to mainly rain as we head tomorrow towards the late evening and into the overnight hours.
And I know you have other responsibilities. Do you have time for one quick question?
Absolutely.
You mentioned model comparisons. And I know the D.C. area is sort of right in the middle of where it can either be below freezing and we have a nightmare, or if it's a couple of temperatures above, we're going to get a break, and it's hard to predict sometime. Tell us a little bit about the models and how you analyze all this.
Well, I mean, we kind of look at a top-down approach, meaning we look at not only the surface, but also some of the upper levels of the atmosphere, see what else is going on. And just a couple thousand feet up, what we're going to see tomorrow, winds anywhere from 60 to 80 miles per hour moving out of the southeast off of the warm Atlantic. That's going to pump in that warmer air a couple thousand feet off the surface, and that will really help change things from the snow to really get and see that mix and then eventually all rain very quickly by tomorrow evening and into tomorrow night.
Wonderful information. Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
It is 6:14. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Well, that's the weather. How about shopping? You able to find eggs this week? I found eggs. $6 a dozen. Organic eggs from the chicken farm in the highest rent district in the country, I think. While I was at it, I got a six-pack of duck eggs, since I was already going into debt, and it sounded like a fun thing to hoard. So I'm covered on eggs, but I'm $10 in the hole for what turns out to be 18 eggs. Miraculously found a pack of chicken thighs, but was not so lucky on milk. Does that sound like your shopping this week? I hope you've had better luck. And that's just an example of what's going on in the stores. Then you take inflation, factor that in, as prices are up 7% year over year in December, the fastest spike since 1982. And then we have COVID-19, and we have the Omicron variant, and you throw that all into the mix, and we got a mess. Now, the administration has been fumbling around, unfortunately, very badly fumbling around on all of this. And I want to go to Vice President Harris. She was asked on the Today Show about the COVID-19 strategy, the Omicron variant, and kind of, you know, should we be changing things up a little bit? And we've heard a lot about the preparedness of the administration, the preparedness of the president, and the whole question of where are we going on COVID. And when the vice president was asked this question, I wasn't fully impressed with the response that we got from Vice President Harris this week. This is the vice president responding on the Today Show.
Does the administration say, you know what, this strategy isn't working, we're going to change strategies? Six former administration officials last week wrote that open letter urging the administration to change course, to change strategy. Is it time?
It is time for us to do what we have been doing, and that time is every day.
What? What kind of a response was that? That was a response that was completely unprepared. Now, because she had been getting such bad poll numbers, they've been putting her out on the circuit, and then she gets a question, which it's a fairly reasonable question to expect somebody could ask, and we're going to do what we're doing every day. It just didn't sound right to me. Now, you may have heard that President Biden was asked a few weeks back as to whether he would run again in 24, and of course he's going to say yes, because if he doesn't say yes, he's immediately a lame duck. So in the same interview on the Today Show this week with Vice President Harris, she wasn't quite on the same page with the president.
Are we going to see the same Democratic ticket in 2024?
Aren't thinking about today. I mean, honestly, that I know why you're asking the question, because this is the part of the punditry and the
right.
The gossip around places like Washington, D.C. Let me just tell you something. We're focused on the things in front of us.
All you had to say was the president and I will be running again in 2024, and we are focused on things today. But she didn't answer the question. She dodged the question. Prep, 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 prep. Big debate in Washington over the filibuster and ending the filibuster. Chuck Schumer has been adamant about ending the filibuster. Let's take you back to 2005 when there was a filibuster debate. This is Senator Schumer then protecting the filibuster. Now he wants to get rid of it.
The ideologues in the Senate want to turn what the founding fathers called the cooling saucer of democracy into the rubber stamp of dictatorship. They want to change the rules in midstream, to wash away 200 years of history. They want to make this country into a banana republic. It'll be a doomsday for democracy if we do.
Well, that's how he felt about it then. He's done a complete 180. Let's also take you back to 2005 with our current president, then Senator Joe Biden. This was his response when Republicans were talking about killing the filibuster.
And we should make no mistake. This nuclear option is ultimately an example of the arrogance of power. It is a fundamental power grab by the majority party.
Okay. Now, more recently, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, back on February 1st of 2019, here's how he addressed it when asked about the filibuster.
The legislative filibuster should stay there, and I will personally resist efforts to get rid of it.
Personally resisting efforts to get rid of it 2.5 years later. Anyway, let's move on to the Senate floor debate, because this was pretty funny. Senator Tom Cotton got on the floor of the Senate and read a very fiery speech against ending the filibuster. What he read was the words of Chuck Schumer. And at the end of it, he put up a huge picture of Chuck Schumer to attribute the remarks to the current Senate Majority Leader. And this is just a little sample of Tom Cotton.
The ideologues in the Senate want to turn the Founding Fathers, what the Founding Fathers called the cooling saucer of democracy, into a rubber stamp of dictatorship. Every word of my speech today was originally spoken by our esteemed colleague, the senior senator from New York, Chuck Schumer.
That's great. Well done, Senator Cotton. 621, it's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us. A lot to cover. We're going to be talking with Jim Trusty next because we've got so much to cover on the legal front. We're going to have to talk to Jim twice this morning. But next up, we're going to talk about the vaccine mandate. What happened on the Supreme Court decision? That's with Jim Trusty. That's next. And then we're going to be back with Jim a little bit later on, and we'll be talking about the January 6th insurrection charges against the Oath Keepers. We've got Jennifer Harper up with some very interesting poll numbers in this hour. John Gizzi is going to join us. We'll have a look at the Supreme Court decision this week, also where the Biden administration is heading, and more congressmen not running for re-election. We'll get into that with John Gizzi this morning. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer is going to join us, and we'll get into the Ukraine situation with Russia, the troop buildup, also North Korea firing more missiles yesterday. We'll get the latest from Tony Schaefer on that. KT McFarland is back. She'll join us in the 7 o'clock hour. We'll talk with KT this morning about the foreign policy situation with Russia, the history with Vladimir Putin. Where does that go next? And Cheryl Apkison is also with us this morning, a very interesting look at the pandemic and also at the FBI. That's all coming up on the Saturday Morning Update. But first, we head over to the WMAL Traffic Center. Michelle Murray is there.
In Virginia and Stafford County, all southbound lanes of Route 1 are closed right near Forest Inn Woods Drive due to a serious accident. And also in the district, a couple of accidents to be aware of. There is an accident on the Suitland Parkway eastbound outbound at South Capitol Street where the left lane remains blocked with the crash activity. And in southeast, Mississippi Avenue is still closed in both directions between 13th Street and 15th Street due to accident investigation activity. Also in Burtonsville, watch out for a work zone right now, westbound on 198 at 29 in the left lane. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy skies on this Saturday. Temperatures, they should reach near the 30-degree mark, so a cold start to the weekend. We'll be very cold tonight, lows back in the teens, and that'll help set the stage ahead of our next winter storm that is set to move through the region Sunday evening and into Monday. Do have a winter storm watch west of D.C. Snow is expected to begin through the afternoon, change over to a period of freezing rain, sleet, and eventually rain as we head Sunday night and into Monday morning. Could see accumulations of 1 to 4 inches around D.C. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
23 degrees in the nation's capital, 624 on the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Generally, we talk to Jim Trusty around 6:45 or so. We got so much to talk with Jim about this morning. We're going to do a double header with him. And first off, Jim Trusty is a partner at IFRA Law. He's the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. He is our go-to guy for everything legal. Jim, good morning, and thanks for double time this morning.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Big story this week, big disappointment for the Biden administration, the Supreme Court ruling on vaccine mandates. And there were two rulings, one in favor of one aspect of the president's vaccine mandate, but a second aspect of his mandate is where he lost. So walk us through the Supreme Court decision.
Sure. And I would say that when you look at these two cases on balance, this is a big loss for the administration. And frankly, a big win for the Constitution. You know, we talked last week, Rick, about the oral argument on this emergency motion making its way to the Supreme Court. And to me, it's really a question of basic constitutionality versus emotionalism or politics, whatever you want to call it. And what happened on the bigger case, which is the OSHA mandate for medium and large businesses to either have a vaccine regimen in place and to, or some exception to that, allow for testing and masking. Well, that was going to affect about 84 million U.S. workers. That was, to me, a very clear federal overreach because, again, the Constitution anticipates that it's up to the states and the local municipalities to make the primary decisions when it comes to public welfare, you know, basing governmental action on the welfare of its citizens. There's not much mandate to allow the federal government to do that under the Constitution. And so there was a 6-3 decision that struck down that big centerpiece of the actions this administration had taken. The opinion basically said that OSHA never had that much authority. They never really had the power to control the workplace to the extreme amount this was talking about. But most importantly, the Constitution doesn't give the federal government that much power. And this came days after we had the very heated oral argument on the emergency motion. So no surprise based on that oral argument that Sotomayor, Kagan, and Stevens dissented. I think the dissent has an awful lot of hysteria. The media has kind of matched it by saying COVID won 6-3. But the bottom line is, you know, it's not like there's 6 Supreme Court justices that voted in favor of COVID infecting people. They were keeping cool heads and looking at the level of intrusion the federal government was trying to do. And I think they came to the right ruling. The reason the other case broke the other way was it was dealing with mandating the same types of actions on medical care workers at facilities that are funded by Medicare and Medicaid. And so once you get into that circle where the federal government is either the one that employs the people that are there or there's a direct financial relationship to that workplace, well, they can put strings on it. And that's kind of where this comes out. They're allowed to put strings on conditions of employment when there are federal employees, federal contracts in play. And so that case tilted 5-4 the other direction. But I don't think either was really a surprise when you look at the Constitution and what the authority is that the federal government's supposed to have. I think long run, federalism is going to remain a big battleground. We're going to get into a year with questions about Roe versus Wade and states' rights when it comes to abortion. So between this administration, the Attorney General, and this Supreme Court, we're going to be talking about federalism a lot.
Well, Jim, that's just one of the topics we want to get with you on this morning. And coming up within the next half hour or so, I want to ask you all about the indictments in the January 6th investigation, including the head of the Oath Keepers, and a couple of really bizarre stories coming out of Baltimore. And that's all coming up within the next half hour. So, Jim, thank you again for so much information that you're providing to us this morning.
Sure, and fun stuff ahead. I'll talk to you soon.
It is 6:28. It's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
In the news at 6:30 on WMAL, a judge has ruled that two alleged gang members charged in the robbery and killing of an off-duty Los Angeles police officer will remain in federal custody without bail. Officer Fernando Arroyos was fatally shot about 9:15 Monday in an unincorporated area of South Los Angeles County. It's in the territory of the Florencia 13 gang. The suspects allegedly targeted him because of two silver chains around his neck. Prosecutors have filed federal charges against three alleged gang members and one associate. Authorities say a fire near a New Jersey chemical plant with flames and smoke visible for miles in the night has now spread to multiple buildings in that complex. It threatens to reach the plant's chemical storage area. The Passaic mayor told residents in a video posted Friday night on Facebook to stay away from that area and to keep their windows closed. The founder and leader of the Oath Keepers militia group will remain in jail until a court hearing next Thursday. Stuart Rhodes made his initial court appearance in Plano, Texas yesterday, that a day after he was arrested on charges that he plotted with others to attack the U.S. Capitol to stop Congress from certifying President Biden's election victory. The seditious conspiracy charges against Rhodes and 10 other Oath Keepers are the first to be levied in connection with the Capitol riot on January 6th. It's 6:31. This is the Saturday Morning Update. Michelle Murray is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Maryland on 95 southbound, just prior to Maryland 100, you will find an accident that is blocking the right lane, so stay to your left and use caution there. Also in the district, be aware of a couple of accidents, one on the outbound Suitland Parkway at South Capitol Street in the left lane, and also you will still find accident investigation activity closing down Mississippi Avenue between 13th Street and 15th Street in Southeast. And in Virginia and Stafford, southbound Route 1 is closed right near Forest and Woods Drive due to an accident. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy skies on this Saturday. Temperatures, they should reach near the 30-degree mark, so a cold start to the weekend. Will be very cold tonight. Lows back in the teens, and that'll help set the stage ahead of our next winter storm that is set to move through the region Sunday evening and into Monday. Do have a winter storm watch west of D.C. Snow is expected to begin through the afternoon, change over to a period of freezing rain, sleet, and eventually rain as we head Sunday night and into Monday morning. Could see accumulations of 1 to 4 inches around D.C. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
23 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:33 on the Saturday Morning Update. Saturday Morning Update. Thank you for joining us. Crazy week in politics, including the notion that Hillary Clinton could run again for president. Jennifer Harper joins us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning, and what are you hearing?
Oh, my goodness. Good morning. That makes me laugh the way you put that. But, yes, Hillary Clinton was definitely in the news this week as a possible contender for president. And when you get down to it all, and she did get a lot of press this week, was a big, big hoopla, but it all got started with a single op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. And they were very bold about this, but, hey, they wrote it, and it ignited the bomb that went off. Anyway, their title of their op-ed was Hillary Clinton's 2024 Election Comeback. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have become unpopular. It may be time for a change candidate. And they said that there was a perfect storm was brewing in the Democratic Party. And, boy, when folks got a look at that on both sides, things kind of went really crazy this week. And I think it was a sort of a, not a breath of fresh air, but just kind of something for both sides to enjoy writing about. Let's just put it that way. According to the National Review, they looked at this as well. They said Shane and Stein, those are the authors of this, conclude their piece by arguing that if Democrats want a fighting chance at winning the presidency in 2024, Mrs. Clinton is likely their best option. So that's how far they went with this. And over at CNN, Rick, they had this to say. It's worth noting that neither of the authors have sterling credentials as Democrats, and so they kind of poo-pooed the idea. And they say their background should give you pause about their intentions and their analysis of the state of the Democratic Party in the 2024 field. So there was some clandestine stuff going on about that. And you have to remember, too, that in December, just very recently, former Fox News anchor Bill O'Reilly, he still has opinion here, he predicted that Mrs. Clinton wanted the presidential nomination. So that's what's going on. It's a kind of a work in progress here. But if you're curious, if you go to HillaryClinton.com, you will see a very prominently displayed section called Hillary's Vision for America. So you got to wonder.
President Biden's taken the gloves off recently against Republicans and any opponents for that matter. But how's that playing out for him in the polls?
Well, if you're following the polls, you'll see a lot of not necessarily great numbers for Mr. Biden this week and in previous weeks, but there's often also a talk about a big partisan divide between Republicans and Democrats and how they feel about the president. And there's a very snappy poll from the Quinnipiac University poll that came out this week. And it found that only 33% of all U.S. adults, all of them, approve of the job President Biden is doing right now. Again, 33% approval rating. And that approval rating, with a partisan divide attached to it, 2% of Republicans approve and 75% of Democrats. You can see where those crazy numbers are coming. There's also one other finding of note. The poll also found that 42% overall believe Mr. Biden is doing more to unite the country than divide it. 5% of Republicans and 84% of Democrats agree with that. Also, some of the reviews that came in of these unbelievable numbers, 33% favorability rating in particular, First TV declared that President Biden was now Underwater Joe. So that's his nickname for the week.
I think we've all seen the coffee mug with George W. Bush on it that says, "Do you miss me now?" How are voters feeling about President Biden? Any Biden buyer's remorse there?
Yeah, that's a good tongue twister, and it's absolutely apropos for this morning because there's definitely some voters' remorse out there. And this was a very telling poll. I'm back on our numbers again, everybody. Sorry about that, but here we go. This is a Heartland Institute Rasmussen Reports national survey, and it found that if the election were held today, the presidential election, 40% of likely U.S. voters would vote to reelect Mr. Biden. But 46% would pick Donald Trump. How about that? And again, this is a Heartland Institute Rasmussen Reports survey. And another 10% would choose some other candidate besides either Biden or Trump. And, of course, there's predictable favoritism. Mr. Trump would get 81% of support from Republican voters. And Mr. Biden would get 75% of Democrats. They said among voters not affiliated with either major party, however, Trump would win by a 16-point margin with 45% to Biden's 29% of the vote. And that's really important to remember because they're all often saying that the independent voters are going to decide the next president. So we'll see about that. And some of the polls like this one are supporting that, and it said less than 1 year into his presidency, 52% of likely voters have an unfavorable impression of President Biden. This is astounding, given the fact that the mainstream media has given Biden the benefit of the doubt so often and glossed over his administration's utter failures concerning the pandemic, inflation, foreign policy, etc. And that came from Chris Talgo. He is a senior editor and research fellow at the Heartland Institute. And if you're wondering, that is a think tank just outside of Chicago.
You mentioned the T word in there. The former president out and about again this weekend. What's he up to?
Oh, boy. We have a big Trump rally happening today, or tonight, I should say. And the reason I wrote about it in detail was because it seemed to be such a joyous occasion for all the voters, Republican voters in Arizona. And he will be in Florence, Arizona. And so I just did a little digging around and went to the Arizona Republican Party and so forth. And their response to having a Trump rally in Arizona was just so positive and upbeat. They were, like, genuinely excited. And it was kind of the fact that Trump could bring joy to the Arizona voters in these dire times. And he'll have 10 guest speakers at the rally, and all of quite a few Republican representatives will be there, like Andy Biggs, Paul Gosar, and Debbie Lesko. Mike Lindell, of course, will be there, and most of the Republican officials from Arizona will be there, along with Alveda King. And just as an example of sort of the joy that's in Arizona right now, they say this Save America rally is a continuation of President Trump's unprecedented effort to advance the MAGA agenda by energizing voters and highlighting America First candidates and causes. And according to Arizona Republican Party Chairwoman Kelly Ward, she said, "I am so looking forward to seeing so many amazing patriots from across our state as we launch into this crucial election year. She says we have to get our country back on course. The best way to do this is restoring voter confidence in our elections and taking back the United States House and Senate while expanding our majority in the state legislature and sweeping, yes, sweeping statewide offices in November. So the enthusiasm is really great there. And also I'll mention Carrie Lake. She's running for governor in Arizona. She's a former Fox News anchor, and she'll also be there at the rally. And she says that part of her agenda will be finishing Trump's wall. I thought that was pretty interesting. If you're curious about the rally, Newsmax is going to carry it. You can check NewsmaxTV.com. The big doings start around 7 p.m. Eastern time, or you can find it in some of the cable and streaming outlets as well. And, oh, one last thing. President Trump's got another rally coming up very quickly. That'll be on January 29th in Conroe, Texas.
Glenn Beck hitting the top of the charts. What's he got going?
Well, Rick, let's talk about Glenn Beck, talk radio host, longtime media presence. He has just written his 21st book. The title of the book is The Great Reset, Joe Biden and the Rise of 21st Century Fascism. That came out on Tuesday, and it's dedicated to all those who believe that men are born to be free. And guess what? It almost immediately hit number one on both Amazon and Barnes & Noble's bestseller list. And it was ahead of all the popular novels, the self-improvement, and the how-to books, et cetera. And The Great Reset, this is according to Glenn Beck, is the single most important topic I have covered in my career, and the movement that could finally snuff out the flame of liberty in America. So he's pretty serious about this one. He's going to talk about all the eroding forces, including the pandemic and climate change fanaticism, he says, and politics. So that's Glenn Beck zooming up to number one rather quickly for his book, but perhaps it has something to do that with that kind of hair-raising title.
Jennifer Harper inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her every day on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Rick.
6:43, the Saturday morning update. We'll get the very latest on the January 6th indictments of the Oath Keepers. That's next. But first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center, and a look at the weather expectations for tomorrow with Alex Liggett. Snow in the forecast.
In the district, you will still find accident investigation activity eastbound on the Sumlin Parkway at South Capitol Street, and that is affecting the left lane. And Mississippi Avenue is still closed with the crash investigation activity in both directions between 13th Street and 15th Street in Southeast. Also, look out for the accident in Stafford on Route 1 southbound near Austin Park Drive. All southbound lanes are closed due to this accident. Earlier accidents in Maryland on northbound 95 at Route 100 now cleared. All lanes are open. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Mostly cloudy skies on this Saturday. Temperatures, they should reach near the 30-degree mark, so a cold start to the weekend. We'll be very cold tonight, lows back in the teens, and that'll help set the stage ahead of our next winter storm that is set to move through the region Sunday evening and into Monday. Do you have a winter storm watch west of D.C.? Snow is expected to begin through the afternoon, change over to a period of freezing rain, sleet, and eventually rain as we head to Sunday night and into Monday morning. Could see accumulations of 1 to 4 inches around D.C. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
23 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:45 on the Saturday morning update.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
The Saturday morning update continues, and if you missed the first half hour of the show, you missed Jim Trustee's analysis of the Supreme Court rulings on the president's vaccine mandate, so you can catch that on the podcast. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. He is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. See him often on Newsmax and Fox News. We have so much to talk about with Jim Trustee this morning, we couldn't squeeze it into his one regular spot here at 6:45 or so. So we're going to get into the other gems of the week. And, Jim, thanks again for doing a doubleheader today.
Sure, happy to do it.
Leader of the Oath Keepers charged with sedition in relation to January 6th events at the U.S. Capitol. First off, he wasn't the only one. And tell us the definition of sedition as it relates to the crime he is accused of.
Sure. Well, you've got 11 defendants altogether that just got charged this week with seditious conspiracy
9 of them had already been charged with other offenses from January 6th. So it's superseding those charges and adding this seditious conspiracy. Essentially, sedition is using force to overthrow the government or delay execution of a U.S. law. And conspiracy means you don't have to succeed in actually overthrowing the government or delaying the execution of the law, but that you did your best, that you took overt acts to try to make that happen. And it's a statute that carries a potential 20-year penalty in prison.
Are all of these 11 defendants linked in terms of a conspiracy?
Yeah, they're all charged with the same conspiracy, which is that they were part of the Oath Keepers and that they had made pretty elaborate plans to enter the Capitol on January 6th and to perhaps interfere with the electoral counting that was scheduled to take place that day. It's an interesting read. It's 48 pages, Rick. There's a lot in there. But here's why there's so much in this indictment. You know, the issue when it comes to conspiracy for sedition is whether it's a bunch of talk or whether they actually took overt acts, whether they took real steps to make this happen. And really, this is a very unusual statute. You don't see a lot of sedition cases. The last one that we saw was in 2010 in Michigan, and that was an acquittal. It was a bench trial where the judge acquitted because it was essentially mere talk. Now, before that, if you go back 26 years ago, we had World Trade Center 1 with the blind sheik, and that was one of the charges for which he was convicted. Of course, it becomes a stronger case when the actual act of terror is completed, like in that case. So in this particular indictment, you see a lot of interesting little facts about how this group was amassing firearms, how they gave guns to what they call quick reaction force teams that basically sat just outside the district waiting for the word if they needed to come in and bring weapons into D.C. for the what they call stacks of individuals from the Oath Keepers that were getting into the Capitol grounds.
So we're talking about 11 defendants. Are there other members of the Oath Keepers involved in this, or is the sort of the organizing force here limited to these 11?
Yeah, it seems like the organizing force is limited to these folks. They came from different states. They had different groups of Oath Keepers that were there. And certainly I don't think this indictment is designed to say everyone that's an Oath Keeper either has been charged or will be charged. But Mr. Rhodes, who's the lead defendant on that, is considered the head of the entire organization. And Rhodes himself, they go to great pains to kind of describe, when he left Texas to come to D.C., he was essentially stocking up on weaponry all the way here. He spent about $6,000 on gun equipment like sights and mounts while he was still in Texas. Then he stopped in Mississippi, bought some more equipment. And there's a lot of communications between these individuals that are part of this indictment. So clearly they got their hands on the, I believe it might have been Signal, but whatever, the encrypted communications these guys were using, probably through flipping some other defendants. And the communications are a large part of this indictment.
The narrative among many of the pundits on the left is to implicate Donald Trump into all of this. Is there anything in the indictment that would involve the former president in any way, even on the fringes?
Yeah, there's actually a smoking gun in the wrong direction for those that were hoping to see Donald Trump caught up with the Oath Keepers. There's a paragraph 77, where essentially the leader of the Oath Keepers is complaining that Donald Trump's not part of the conspiracy. He says, all I see Trump doing is complaining. I see no intent by him to do anything. So the patriots are taking it into their own hands. In other words, we can't rely on Donald Trump to engage in seditious conspiracies, so we're going to do it without him. That is flaming, exculpatory information. It says a lot about whether or not you're going to see any other highly visible defendants added to this indictment. I think the answer is no, and it ends with that paragraph 77.
Well, Jim, on behalf of everyone listening to you this morning, thank you for reading those 48 pages of the indictment and getting to the root of the matter, because I know I didn't have time to do it, and I'm not sure that that many of the folks listening this morning did either.
Well, Rick, if I had any social life, I wouldn't have read it, but that's what I do.
Daryl Brooks, the defendant in Waukesha, was in court this week, of course, that in Wisconsin, where he drove through the Christmas parade. He had been arrested for trying to run down the mother of his child. This was, of course, prior to the incident where he drove through the Christmas parade. He had been released on minimal bail, basically got his wrist slapped and was out. There's a similar story out of Baltimore, and I guess I just scratch my head when we see all of the attention to the Me Too movement and to sexual harassment cases. Here you have actual violence perpetrated against women, and these guys seem to just walk.
Yeah, this is an amazing little story out of Baltimore, and maybe it's an outlier and maybe it's not, but a man named Luther Trent took to the airwaves late last week to basically announce that he had been treated unfairly by the progressive prosecutor Marilyn Mosby in the state's attorney's office in Baltimore City. And usually when you hear a defendant say they were treated unfairly, it has kind of a different punchline. Well, this guy had basically gotten it in his head that his ex-girlfriend was not really an ex. And so he got high, he went to her house, and he lit the entire house on fire with gasoline while she and two roommates were inside the home. It was originally charged as attempted murder, first-degree arson, numerous other charges. Thankfully, the women escaped the fire unharmed. The state's attorney's office let him plead to first-degree arson. I don't know that that's anything outrageous there. That's a serious felony. But they cut a deal with him that let him out in less than 6 months. And, Rick, what we usually see are victims and police officers and other participants in the criminal justice system coming out and saying, man, that was a ridiculous soft deal. In this case, Luther Trent came out and complained, and he said, yeah, I want to be out, but this is outrageous. I shouldn't be out of jail because I could have done a lot more damage. And people who are in that situation, they should expect to get time. So we're now at a point in this bizarro world of progressive prosecutors where they're even too progressive for the bad guys who come out and say that was too much.
What more do we know about the state attorney, Marilyn Mosby?
Well, Marilyn did not have a good week because Luther got his airwaves out there. And then the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore announced that Marilyn Mosby had been indicted federally for loan application fraud and for essentially coronavirus relief fraud. 2 counts of perjury, 2 counts of false statement in the loan application. And the details of these indictments are pretty bad.
So help me out here. I think she is the lead attorney for the city of Baltimore, and she's got a nice little laundry list of charges from what I can see here.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, obviously very upsetting when you have the chief law enforcement officer for the city of Baltimore, you know, under the gun for an indictment. The first 2 counts, the perjury counts, are essentially her taking out loans on her own deferred compensation. It's like $40,000 and $50,000. Where you have to assert that there was something that hit you hard from coronavirus, like losing a job or losing a home. That's the lie. And that one is that she pretended that she had taken harm and there hadn't been any economic harm. But that one's a little bit ticky-tack to me. You know, she's taking money that she's eventually owed. The bigger problem for her, both I think in terms of public perception and the facts of the indictment, are the false statements in the loan application. This is a sitting state's attorney. They don't make a ton of money. They do okay in Baltimore. But she bought 2 homes in Florida, one for about $430,000, one for about $490,000, one in Kissimmee, the other in Longboat Key, beautiful stretch on the Gulf of Florida. She buys these 2 houses, and they specifically ask, when you're applying for loans, do you have any sort of liens? And she and her husband had $45,000 in IRS liens.
Ooh.
On them.
The IRS, and she's the state attorney?
Yeah, having some problems paying back her taxes and then lying about it when you buy your luxury home on the Gulf of Florida, not a good picture.
So what does that mean for her career? Can she be recalled? What is the process for discipline there?
Well, we're talking about Baltimore. I mean, she might get a promotion. I'm not sure. But the system's had some real problems. I mean, from my view, there was a little bit of a glasnost, a little period of time when the state's attorney's office in Baltimore had some very effective leadership with Greg Bernstein, brought the right people in, respected, experienced prosecutors, got some good results. But that place has been snake bit ever since and for a long time before. So I don't know what to tell you about the politics of Baltimore, how it's going to play out. but she'll get her opportunity to go to trial sometime this year.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law. As always, Jim, thank you so much. And you can follow Jim on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer.
Have a good weekend. Thanks, Rick.
We've got the 7 o'clock news coming up with Heather Curtis. Then we're back with John Gizzi. We'll take a look at that Supreme Court decision when it comes to vaccine mandates. Cheryl Atkinson will join us, a look at some interesting misses of the FBI. And coming up at 7:35, we'll talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. We'll get his read on the military buildup at the Ukraine border of the Russians and also on the cybersecurity attack that happened against Ukraine yesterday, the latest on that cyber attack coming up. And we'll talk with KT McFarland. She is back from some extended travel, and we'll ask KT about what's next with Vladimir Putin. How do we handle Russia? And that's all coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, and we'll keep an eye on that weather forecast for you as well. Alex Liggett is in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center. We talked with Alex at length earlier this morning to get a read on what to expect with incoming snow tomorrow afternoon.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. The one radio station for you to depend on. All day, every day. 105.9 FM, WMAL, a Cumulus Media station.